This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Temps, and each week with an inspiring guest, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. So, here we go. This week's conversation is super special to me for reasons that will partly become more apparent in the next episode you hear, but also such a wonderful guest for me to chat to, one of my all-time favorite themes, self-love. And we covered so much. So Ruby Dahl is a poet, an author, an advocate for all things mental health, and we really got on. Funnily enough, we found quite a few things in common, a lot of shared interests, great love of books. And in this conversation, we really go through the journey, you know, the healing journey. And yes, we use those buzzwords a lot because sometimes certain words, they just really hit it on the head. And you find yourself listening back to a podcast episode and be like, I really just got hooked on some terms there. So having moved to the UK as a refugee, having dealt with personal family tragedy from a young age, Ruby shares how she didn't always have the template that she needed as a young person on what it is to look out for yourself, advocate for yourself, and really just feel safe in any way as a child growing up. That is transformatively different for her now. And I think there's a real mix of practical tips alongside the kind of incredible storytelling you'd expect from someone that has, I actually didn't count before I started recording this, but someone who has published many books. I'll also add, if you're ever considering signing up for our subscription on Apple Podcasts, where you get extended ad-free episodes of both of the podcasts I host, this could be a really good episode to do that. We have a lot of fun behind the paywall on this one, and that also unlocks the whole back catalogue as well on both podcasts, so you can revisit some of your favourite conversations and just get that little bit extra, because often some of the most kind of vulnerable or reflective moments come up when we take that pause and look back on the conversation we've just had. Or there'll be things that the guests wish they'd said, and they bring them up. And an exclusive group of subscribers get to hear those parts. So something to think about as you get towards the end of today's episode, if you're enjoying it. For now, we'll get into the episode in a moment. But first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
My name is Ruby Dahl. I am a British Afghan Sikh, which is essentially a minority of Sikh faith, which is from Afghanistan. So my parents, my mum left with her family. They were not married at the time. They were very young. My dad left with his. They moved to India, and over there they felt like perhaps there's going to be some hope for us. We will be able to find some sort of safety. This happened after the Taliban war. So in the late 1980s, there was a lot of conflict, there was a lot of political conflict, and minorities such as those of Sikh and Hindu faith were not safe in Afghanistan at the time. There was no support for Afghans in India. There was no financial support. There was no stability. They faced a lot of, you know, hardship. They faced homelessness. They had no money. They had to start all over again. And so after my parents got married, they decided to move, myself and my brother, as did lots of Afghan Sikhs and Hindus. They all decided that the West was probably a better place for us to move to. So we immigrated to the UK. I was only three when we immigrated from India to the UK. We had no money, we had no house, we had nothing at all. And we relied on the government, and something really, really tragic happened a year later, and I lost my mum. Events of which I don't really disclose to anyone. And after this, we faced a lot of homelessness. We faced a lot of hardship. We moved from house to house. My brother and I were put on child protection plans because my dad, you know, treated his PTSD in a way that was very harmful to him. It was very toxic to him. And I spent much of my childhood just dealing with my grief without really understanding that I was dealing with grief, because I had lost a parent, right? I had lost a parent at age three, and it always felt like I was going to lose another. as I was growing up, it always felt like I didn't really know where I stood. I was always on thin ground. I didn't really understand, you know, what it was like to have a family, what it was like to have a normal family. And I kind of just grew up in that way. You know, I kind of just dealt with my grief and dealt with my very first healing journey, which I began when I was 3 in that particular way. And that's the best that I can explain my early journey of when I came here.
Yeah. And, you know, I want to highlight something even there so far that we talk a lot about on the pod, how these early years, that is the only frame of reference we have. So when you're dealing with moving around all the time, when you've lost a parent, you know, one of these things that we never want to think will happen to a child, and yet it does happen. There is something there that I can see that was then your normal was, okay, well, what other tragedy am I waiting for? What new kind of the rug being pulled under me that I have to leave this school, or we have to move house again, or maybe, you know, the finances get worse, my dad's drinking gets worse. And so like being in that kind of survival mode doesn't sound, you know, hugely dissimilar to what you were fleeing in many ways.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like I was always in survival mode as a child. I feel like I took on a carer role quite quickly. So I have an older brother. He's 2 years older than me. And having him by my side really helped me cope through those years, because it felt like I wasn't alone. It felt like I had someone there who was going through the same experiences as I was. But essentially, both of us grew up way too quickly. It felt like, while kids my age are out going to the park, going to the beach with their family on the weekend, I used to go to the hospital ward and sit by my dad because he's had another episode of like drinking too much. And it was just so difficult because it used to happen there was always like a spiral. There was like weeks of it being good, and then suddenly it would get really, really bad. And for me, that was normal, not having one parent and having another who was so dysfunctional. And like when I was a child, we'll go into it later, I guess, but from now, like I want to say, when I was a child, I used to blame a lot. I used to be like, okay, my life is like this because he doesn't fix up, because he doesn't stop drinking. But when I grew up, I kind of realized that he was on his own healing journey, and he was trying to function in whichever way he could to deal with his trauma. And my grief journey was different to his. But as a child, you don't really understand that. You just want your parent, like you want both parents, but where there's one, you just want the one. And when you don't have that, you don't have stability. When you don't have stability, what do you really have? You go into survival mode and you say, okay, I need to take care of myself. But now I also have a grown adult as a child of someone who's got an addiction. I've got a grown adult to take care of as well. That's a lot to put on a child. Like that's a lot to expect from a child. And so from a very, very early, you know, age, I realized that I just need to be responsible. And I didn't really get the time to be a kid. I didn't get time to enjoy myself and enjoy my youth in the way that I had seen, or I guess viewed other people as enjoying. All I really knew was wake up, survive, get through the next day, make sure something bad doesn't happen. If it does, what's my backup plan? Do that, essentially. And that's how it always went. It was a spiral.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think from a very young age, we can recognize that these things can bed deep into our psyche, and we can then be waiting for, okay, what is the next disaster? And at the same time, it's a time of life where you can conceptualize that to an extent. But what you can't conceptualize is your identity. That hasn't really formed yet, you know, particularly looking as far back as when you lost your mum. So then you're aware of the trauma and the stress in the household, but you're not aware of you as a separate entity. And what that then leads to is, well, dad's gone off the rails again. What did I do? You know, what do I need to do differently every time to make this not happen, even though it keeps happening and my life feels like a countdown to the next time? And then it happens over and over.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's one of the biggest things that I learned when I was trying to move forward in my like path to self-love. So the biggest thing that changed everything for me right now as an adult is learning to love myself. The biggest obstacle to me loving myself was that my identity was so entwined with my dad. So anytime something would happen with him, I would be unhappy. So say that he has gone off the rails again, I would stop my plans. Got a plan with a friend, I'm not going to go. I have a school trip, not going to happen. I have anything to do, it would just suddenly stop. I tied my happiness. So when he had highs, I was in a great place. But when he had lows, I was in a horrible place. And a huge part of a child's, especially in the early stages, child attachment, you form your identity based on the relationship that you have with your primary caregivers. Now, when that attachment is disassociated or it's messy, it's tricky, it's, you know, completely off the rails, you don't really know who you are. You don't know who you are to yourself because you don't know who you are to them. And one of the main ways in which I learned that as I was growing up was I learned that I was always putting my life on hold. I was always pausing my life whenever something went wrong with him. And in order for me to have an identity of my own, I needed to separate myself from him. And I think so many people, kids, adults who have parents who have some form of addiction, find it very difficult to do that. They find it very difficult to just detach, to disassociate themselves from their parent and the path that they're on. Because my healing journey and how I am moving on from the grief that I'm experiencing as a child is different to his healing journey. But as a child, I'm attaching it to him. And if he's doing well, I'm doing well. If he's not doing well, I'm not doing well. And so I am him, essentially. And that's how it went on for a really long time.
Yeah, and it kind of doubles down on the effect of the grief in a certain way, because you're experiencing not only your own process there, but also how he is trying and struggling to cope with that as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the biggest ways in which I made my peace with that was when I learned how different grieving journeys are. Okay, so my grieving journey and your grieving journey of the same person can be very different, but also my grieving journey for different people is different, right? So for instance, losing my mom is different, losing the friend is different. In the same way, and I mentioned this in my book as well, losing my mom was very, very traumatic for me. But when I lost my uncle to COVID-19, that was a different kind of heartbreaking, earth-shattering grief for me. And the difference was because I had a life with him. I had shared all my experiences with him. I had grown up with him. And losing my mom was something that changed the trajectory of my entire life. And mostly it was because of the aftermath, because of the domino effect of what it did to my dad and our life going forward. But losing my uncle felt so, so heartbreaking. And so when I was trying to heal from the past, and when I was trying to move on from this particular grieving journey of mine and form a better relationship with my dad, the first thing I did is understand that my grieving journey was not the same as his. For him, losing his wife, especially in the way that he had, would have been so heart-shattering that nothing that I would say and nothing that I would feel about losing her would ever compare to that. And so understanding how different grief journeys work and how we move through grief is so important so that you could hold compassion for other people as well. And so distancing myself from him and then also creating balance in our relationship, a huge part of that was understanding why and how his healing journey worked and why he was in the place that he was, essentially.
Yeah, and I think that's a great way of describing healthy separation there, that this isn't you shutting him out. This is you understanding that you are having different experiences and that's okay. And particularly, I want to put a pin in what you said there of there not being anything you could say or do that would make it okay. You know, that is a huge burden to be carrying as a young person, and it's a huge burden to lift off yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's something that children or people with addiction experience a lot, where you feel responsible for your parent. You feel responsible for their state. When they're doing well, you're so happy. Like, I remember feeling so, so content and happy when my dad, and that was most of the time, like these were like 6 months of great and then 2-3 weeks of like horrible. Mm-hmm. And those 6 months are like so wonderful and I'm so happy and I'm so content. And then suddenly there's 3 weeks of horribleness and I would feel like I've done something. What did I do that triggered him? What did I do that could have set this off? Where's my part in this? What's my part to play in this? Then I would trace back my actions. And for a 10-year-old, 11-year-old child, these are very heavy burdens to carry. And one of the biggest things that has set me free is to free myself from this burden and to say there's nothing that I could say or do that will make this better for you. All I can do is separate myself be my own person and find happiness within myself. And that's the biggest thing that you could do for yourself.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of these realizations, it sounds like you had a real awareness of how your experiences were differing from, you know, the kids at school, other people around you. You know, I'm sure family members would highlight and affirm like the scale of what happened losing your mum even before you could fully understand it. How were you able to have some of these realizations? Like, what was the approach there?
So when it happened, I had my dad's family around me. So I had my aunties, I had my uncles, I had a huge group of people who were ready to take me and my brother in. So it never felt like we were alone. Whenever my dad had a low period, again, my brother and I were not alone. We were always either taken to our cousin's house, to our auntie's house. Every weekend I was taken care of. And so one realization I had that my life isn't normal and I don't have a mom or a normal dad was literally one day I was at my auntie's house and she had four kids of her own, by the way, Bobby. She had four kids of her own. And me and my brother would also go to her house on the weekend. And we're of Sikh faith, so the boys have long hair. Mm-hmm. She would spend 2 hours washing every single one of like our hair because we were so young, right? I was like probably 7, 8, my brother like 10. So she would literally, 6 kids would go in, have a shower, get their hair washed, go out. It was great. It was one of the childhood memories that are sweet to me because of how loving my aunt was. But I remember her sitting down with her daughter, who was my age. She's 6 months older than me. And the way she was caressing her, she was doing her hair. And her daughter, my cousin, was, I don't know, having a little tantrum or something, just like a little, what a kid would. And the way that she was taking care of her and the way that she was giving her attention. And now this woman loved me. I was her niece. She cared about me a lot. But I had never seen that kind of maternal love from her. I had never seen it from anyone. And so that was one of the instances where I kind of realized that, okay, this is lacking in my life. But a lot of times it was just, I come from a community which is very small. We're all, you know, very small minority community, Afghan Sikh faith, British Afghan community that lives here. And so we would go to the Sikh temple, which is called the Gurdwara, and people would look at me in a different way. There would be whispers. I would see ladies who would give me like a pitying gaze. And I'd realize it was just those tiny moments that I'd realize that my life is not the same. And I think these experiences...
Not for nothing. I feel like it's worth sharing with listeners that might be less familiar. It's so distinctly un-Sikh in many ways. You know, this idea that you are all equal, and even that's built right into these places of worship, that you all eat together, you pray together. There's a very kind of communal aspect. And yet, you know, mm-hmm. This kind of judgment and this awkwardness is creeping in.
It was crazy. And I think... because we're such a small community, everything that would happen at home with my dad, people would know. People would know. It would be something that would spread. And so I remember very distinctly, I went to a girls' school. I was in high school when I had a friend, a very, very good friend. And in our year, there was another girl who was from my community. And my best friend, I was probably in year 8 or year 9. My best friend, we were walking home from school when she said to me, "Do you know what X said about you?" And my best friend had no idea about, you know, my dad's alcohol. She had no idea, like, what I was going through at home. And she goes, "That girl, you know, the ex-girl from your community said that you shouldn't be friends with Ruby. Her family's really bad, and her dad, and so on, and this has happened with her, and that's happened with her." And I remember going home that day, and I was so upset. Like, I was so sad, because I was like, this is like a 13-year-old girl, like, from my community saying this about me. And I think it was just moments like that, like, tiny moments like that, where I realized that, okay, something's wrong, something's not right here. And people feel a certain way about me when they see me. And so when I was growing up, one of the biggest things that I wanted to do, one of the biggest changes that I wanted to make in my life was to stop that pitying gaze. So I know it means nothing, okay, Bobby? I know that the way people look at you, the way they treat you has nothing to do with how you feel about yourself. But when you spend your entire childhood being looked at in a certain way, when you spend your entire childhood being treated a certain way by a group of people who are all you've ever known in terms of this is the people that I'm going to stay within, essentially, because that is what we are. We're social beings. We stay in our little huddles. We stay in our little communities. You go anywhere in the world, people have their ways of living. People have their villages, their towns, their culture, their rituals. And so these are my people. And so the biggest thing that I wanted to take forward was I no longer wanted that pity and gaze. And so when I decided to like follow my dreams and decided to write books, the same people who would look at me with like, you know, just a pitying way would look at me and they'd be like, we're so proud of you. Mm-hmm. And I know that that shouldn't be the defining moment of me feeling good, but it did contribute to it quite a lot because it felt very cyclical to me. It felt very much like I have done something for myself, but I've also done something for my mum and for my dad because I've changed their narrative in a way as well. And that's what I really wanted to do. I wanted to change the narrative for myself, but also for them. And I guess that's one of the big things. The moment that I started feeling good about myself, the moment that I started feeling like I am doing something with my life and I'm changing my life around, somehow the environment around me started changing as well. And perhaps it wasn't a, they look at me a certain way. It was more of a, I look at me a certain way and they're now reflecting that energy that I'm giving off because I'm no longer relying on other people for that validation. I'm no longer relying on people for that affirmation. I'm giving it to myself. And I guess that's what really changed the way that I felt about myself.
Yeah, it's true. It's such a kind of complicated, nuanced thing, right? Because like you said earlier, yeah. It doesn't really kind of have a direct bearing that we want approval and acceptance, but that ultimately has to come from us. Yeah. In the same way, like self-love isn't really something that I believe can be taught to you from other people. So if you take the example of your aunt, you saw how much she loved her daughter and showed that care. And that can, you know, help her daughter grow up with a certain level of self-esteem that can make practicing self-love easier or more accessible, but it doesn't teach it. You know, like the nearest thing would be seeing the role models around you practicing self-love for themselves as something that you can replicate, but it's still your own thing to learn. And it feels like a parallel here that, you know, when working on how you view yourself, yes, other people's perceptions can factor into that, but if you hate yourself and everyone loves you, there's a disconnect there. If everyone hates you and you love yourself, there's a disconnect that then is kind of helpful, you know? Then like if you can build that solid stuff inside yourself and then also kind of find the right people around you to accept you and reflect that back, it's a double win. Yeah. You know, how can you not believe it then? Makes it so much harder to question.
I definitely think it's a two-way thing. I just want to touch upon the part where you said about if we see people around us expressing self-love in a healthy way, we learn about it in that way. However, we still need to learn ourselves. So what do you do when you grow up in an environment where you're not seeing your primary caregivers express self-love, right? So you're not like, I know that it's not something that can be seen directly, but sometimes it's in the way that you hold yourself. Sometimes it's in the way that you talk about yourself. You know, like if you have a sibling who's always like, oh, you know, I hate my arm fat and I don't like the way I look. You can already tell that this person doesn't feel confident in their skin. So essentially, I have not seen self-love be practiced as I was growing up. So I didn't know what self-love was. When I turned to social media, especially in the previous 5 years, I was told that self-love is waking up for a 5 a.m. yoga session. I was told that self-love is meditating. I was told that self-love is going for a run to the park. Mm-hmm. It's going to the gym. It's eating healthy food. So I tried to do all of that. Bobby, I tried to do all of that and I still couldn't figure out why I wasn't feeling good about myself. I tried to go to the gym 3-4 times a week. I tried to eat very healthy. I tried to drink 2 liters of water. I tried to meditate. I tried to read self-help books. I still wasn't getting there. And so my secret to self-love, my way of coming to terms with loving myself, was first healing myself. It was going back, facing my past trauma, looking at my previous memories, all those times where I felt alone, all those times where I felt sad, upset, and asking myself, why did I feel sad at this point? Is it because of what this person did, or is it because of how I felt? Is it because this happened, or is it because, you know, I didn't feel loved? And that's what it all came down to. So my relationship with my dad, me being affected by his alcohol, that's his healing journey. He was struggling. I know that there were times where he couldn't be the parent that he wanted to be, but he was on his own grief journey. Why was I so affected by it? Why was I eating myself up because of the way that he was reacting? As a child, I understand. That's what you do. But when you grow up, I'm now in my late teens. I'm in my early 20s. Why am I still doing it? Because, as we said earlier, I tied my identity to it. I tied my self-worth to it. And I think the biggest thing that you could do for yourself when you're practicing self-love is firstly, as you said, detach yourself. You say, okay, I need to find happiness and self-worth within myself. I need to detach myself from how this relationship makes me feel. And I need to figure out what's going on with me. Okay, what's going on with me? I failed in an exam back when I was in sixth form. That really affected my self-esteem. And for this reason, I don't have confidence when I apply to interviews. Or when I was in year eight, this particular girl said this thing to me. I didn't feel very good. And now every time I look in the mirror, I see my nose, which she said was big. Like, so you have these like little examples which help bring it all together, and you realize, okay, so I feel a certain way, like a certain negative way about myself, mm-hmm. because of this thing that's happened in my childhood experiences. So it all comes back to your childhood. It all comes back to, in order for me to practice self-love and go for the walks and go, because that is very important. That is very important in practicing self-care, which is a form of self-love. I need to do the internal deep stuff first. I need to look within. I need to look at my past trauma, and I need to unpick everything, and I need to really get to know myself. And that was the biggest thing for me, like in practicing self-love. Only now can I go to the gym and enjoy it and reap its benefits. Only now can I go on a walk, listen to a podcast, or listen to an audiobook and really, really take it in and feel the peace, as opposed to the monsters that are constantly in my head. So the one thing that I propose and I say often is that every like negative, painful event in your life, it triggers a brand new healing journey. So say you lost your grandparent age 10, that's one healing journey. Your best friend moved away when you were 15, another healing journey. You lost a parent, another. You're on all these different healing journeys. And some healing journeys you can heal from or reach like a better, softer place in sooner than others. So maybe you've healed from your best friend moving away because you've made so many amazing friends since then, but perhaps you still can't get over your first heartbreak because it was that terrible. And so what you need to do is firstly understand that self-love is not about being in this positive mindset that we propose all the time, waking up in the morning and being like, I am ready to conquer the day. I am ready to go on that 5K walk or that 2K run. No, sometimes it's just waking up and saying, I'm having a horrible day today and my heart is hurting and I just want to lay in bed. That's okay. That's mm-hmm. completely fine. Because self-love and healing go hand in hand. You can't heal and just not, you know, be on your self-love journey. And I think that's the biggest turning point for me when I realized that there's various things that I'm healing from. But the reason why I'm not healing fully is because I'm not giving myself the space to love myself. Now, to love myself doesn't mean to chant, I love me, to the mirror every day. To love myself means I'm healing. Okay, let me sit with myself and actually heal. Let me have a difficult conversation with this friend who is overstepping my boundaries. Let me go to therapy. Let me break up with my boyfriend who is being very, very controlling. Let me do all of this. These are acts of self-love, mm-hmm. Bobby. These are acts of self-love that are very hard to do. And more than you sell on Instagram, so you have to write a book about it.
Well, I'm very glad you have, because you're so right. You know, it is all of these difficult parts. You know, there's no getting around it. I love a bath bomb. I love all the sort of marketed self-care stuff that we see. But we can't negate the difficult stuff too. That is so important. And it is concerning the way you see self-love, you know, marketed at people. It is a very sort of obscure, narrowed down sort of, yeah, like toxic positivity kind of version of it that doesn't make any sense. It doesn't do the job. And also there's a lot of it that just is quite appropriative or whitewashed or oversimplistic. You know, that's like, it's my main gripe with yoga is, why are we saying namaste, which is a greeting at the end? You know, that is a very simple example how you're missing a bit of the point of this practice if you can't even get some of the basic cultural context right. That's where I'm like, this is a money grab and it's appropriative, versus this is actually a lesson in caring for ourselves that we can really benefit from.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's toxic positivity. I don't know if you've had the term, but sometimes it can seem like that. You know, for someone who is on a very difficult healing journey, say you've just had a heartbreak and you are trying to come through from that, you open your Instagram page and see this constant mention of like being in love is great. Being in love is so beautiful. Having the right person is so wonderful. Love, love, love. Like, it can really overwhelm you. And in the same way, someone who is struggling with body image issues, waking up and opening your TikTok and seeing someone who's eating so healthily all day and telling you, like, oh, this is a day in the life of a fitness trainer. This is how I eat my food. This is how I take care of myself. And the thing is, I love that for people, okay? I love that for people who are in a good place. But you're not always in a good place. So why can't you show the bad days if that's what you're promoting? Like, if you're promoting an all-inclusive, wholesome life of, like, I am a self-care, self-love content creator. I'm going to show you how to love yourself, essentially. Do this, 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 and you're going to be in a great place. Okay, what about the days when you're not doing that? Like, show me the hard days. Show me the days that I can relate to. Because when I see all the good days, I start to think that I'm not loving myself. And I think the journey to self-love...
What's wrong with me? Everyone else makes it look so easy.
So easy.
It's as much kind of accepting your flaws as your strengths. Giving yourself time to have a bad day as well as giving yourself time to go for a smoothie and post it on Instagram.
Self-love isn't like just feeling all the time. It's living. It's going through the motions and healing and trying to come through from the highs and lows of life and accepting that, like, when you learn more about yourself, you learn that, yes, there are parts to love and like, and there are also parts that are messy, and that's okay. It's something that comes with a package, and you just accept the package as it is. Because for so long, it was seen as such a taboo concept, like self-love. What is self-love? Eventually, when the emphasis was put on it and everyone was talking about it, it just became this whimsical concept of, I love myself, and so on. Let's all practice self-love. And we don't really understand it anymore. Like, we don't really understand what it means to love ourselves without thinking about the self-care practices. Like, if I was to sit down with a group of people right now and ask them, what do you think self-love means? I think at least 9 out of 10 people will say, to me, it means taking care of my health. To me, it means going to the gym. To me, it means grabbing a coffee. To me, it means seeing my best friends. And that is all one form of self-love. Yes. But what about the other form of self-love?
Yeah.
And nobody talks about that.
No, it's true. And it's such a dangerous disconnect because so many of those things you listed, like going to the gym can be incredibly healthy for people. It can also be such a trap. If you hate yourself and you're like, oh, maybe if I go to the gym twice as much and I'm twice as thin, then everything changes and I'll be as happy 24/7 as the people online. And that's how I would kind of define toxic positivity for people, this idea of pushing any kind of negative thought, negative emotion out of the way, and you can only be happy. It's very dangerous. It's completely unrealistic. And it has the opposite effect, because then you don't love yourself, because it's conditional on, oh, I only get to love myself. I only get to be validated by other people if I'm happy all the time. Yeah. Scary. Like, it makes me think of, do you know that Black Mirror episode where people are rating each other?
Oh my God, yes,
and everyone's
yes,
got to pretend to be happy because otherwise it'll affect their ratings.
And helpful and everything. And yeah, I remember that episode. I think that was great. And that was a great take on what we're doing with self-love. Because I want to refer to two things. The first one's the gym. Firstly, the gym isn't even inclusive, like in terms of it doesn't even feel safe for people who actually want to make a change in their life. Now, when I say this, I mean like, I've gone to the gym and I've seen people who are above a particular weight, which people see as acceptable, above the acceptable, whatever that means, weight. And people look at them weird, like, people are like, why is this person in the gym? And then it's like, but isn't the gym supposed to make you healthy? Like, aren't you supposed to go to the gym if you want to change something or work on yourself? Like, it's not just made for people who have muscles. Like, it's not just made for people who are having like 3 protein shakes every... If someone has low self-esteem, the gym is probably going to make it worse. It's probably going to make it worse when they go there and they see people who look different to them, who look more like a body type that they think that they will be happier in, when really you're the happiest in your own skin. But it can trigger a lot with the gym. And the second thing is that when I say that it's not even a safe spaces are very important for self-love. And at the end of it, like, it's not just, like, when I say safe spaces, I mean safe spaces with people. Self-love these days, it's not just let's do self-care activities. It's also a me, me, me. And I love that for a lot of people. I love that, like, we are focusing on ourselves and it's very important too. But we are social beings at the end of it, Bobby. And our identity is affected from our childhood attachments. The way that we feel and think about ourselves and how much we love ourselves is affected by the early attachments that we form. So how can we think that when we're adults and we're trying to form our identities, it's somehow detached completely from our close relationships? It's not possible. At the end of it, like, we are social beings. And so in order to truly practice self-love, you need to have a safe space with people who are good for you and healthy for you. You can't do it just by yourself. And that's something that I always advise, and I say that self-love is very, like, I need to be my own person. However, I am flourishing when I have a safe space that I can turn to on days when I do need people, essentially. And the culture has become so me, me, me. Like, I don't need people. I can flake whenever I want to. I can put my needs first all the time. And the thing that we need to understand is that sometimes putting your needs first is putting other people's needs first. Like, say you want to go for a walk and you don't want to go alone. You're like, you know what? Let me ask my friend. We have a great chat when we go on a walk. Or you want to take your dog for a walk. My neighbor has a dog as well. And, we have such good chats. We have such a good time. Let me take him. I want to go for a coffee. Maybe I'll call my mom. We'll have a good conversation. Like, you think about these relationships. You think about these people. You enjoy yourself. You feel safe with certain people. And so when you're practicing self-love, when you're trying to figure out who you are, you need to also figure out who's good for you and who's bad for you.
Yeah. Eventually. And I think that's a really well articulated kind of balance there, right? Because when you're first sort of leaning into self-love, and I think particularly elements of self-care, people can get lost on this where it feels selfish. And that can be exacerbated by coming from certain backgrounds, whether it's Afghani, Sikh, or, you know, we're similar here in Ireland, where it's very kind of communal. And a lot of how you show love to others is through acts of service, is through putting other people first. And so it can be really challenging to grapple with, actually, the best way I can look after me and those people around me can also be prioritizing my own needs. And, you know, like you say, there's still a balance there, because absolutely you deserve to be prioritized. That shouldn't be at the detriment, you know. So what is and isn't the detriment? So having boundaries and putting those up when someone's affecting you negatively, positive. Shutting everyone out, then we're going a bit too far. That's not so good.
Yeah. Like, flaking is something that I talk about quite often. And it's not just that we flake on people, but sometimes other people can flake on us too. And one way of looking at it is, oh my God, this person's being such a flake. Every time we make a plan, this person cancels. Another way to look at it, and that's when you think about not just other people, not just yourself, but other people too. And it's so important to your mental health and well-being to think about the people that are close to you, is why is this person constantly flaking? What's going on with them? Are they okay? You know, like, what's actually happening with them? And to maintain health and positivity in your life, sometimes you need to, you know, think about, okay, what's going on with this person? Because stability of their life equals to stability in my life. And that's how I see it. We are all a network of people. And so self-love isn't just me, 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 me. It's me, the network around me, and then how we can all help each other and be happy and safe and connected, and also doing the best thing that we can for ourselves.
Yeah. And let's pause on that, actually, because I think there's something there where we're not encouraged. We're not raised to be that direct with people, but there can be something really wonderful about it. I've had very similar experiences where I've approached it as, I've noticed you're canceling a lot recently. I'm just wondering if everything's okay. And that is a way where you're directly addressing it, but you're coming at it from a point of, like, interest and concern and care, as opposed to, so, canceling again? what are we doing? And generally, either there is something going on, and then that opens a dialogue that person may not have started for themselves, or they're just being a bit useless lately and they're probably not going to do it again now that you've pointed it out. Or at least next time they'll bother being on time or whatever. And so we're going to start wrapping up. I'm keen to hear where people can find your book. Due to the magic of podcasting, this episode is going to go out on the week of release as well.
Oh, amazing. That's wonderful. So yes, I am releasing my very first personal development book called The Path to Self-Love. It's being published by Penguin Random House. It's available on Amazon, Waterstones, Barnes & Noble, anywhere and everywhere where you can find books. You can find my book, The Path to Self-Love. And I'm also on social media under the name r.dahlwriter. And yeah, I'm literally on every single social media platform. So definitely follow me on there too.
There you go. And folks, that's how you know Penguin Random House is doing just fine, that you know to say Barnes & Noble. Like, you've got that international distribution on the go.
That's it. And it's a dream come true. I just hope it does well and reaches the people it needs to.
I'm sure it will. Well, thank you so much for this. In the bit behind the paywall, I want to get more into the gym stuff because I have further thoughts and questions for you on that. But for now, thank you so much.
No worries.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.